dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who has been in the vanguard of the forces of light and good in that war for, well, many years now is our friend Diana West. She is a longtime syndicated columnist, a best-selling author, and, of course, a very active contributor to the public policy debate through her own blog at dianawest.net and our program and others as well. Her books are The Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Diana West, that is a topic I want to turn to with you. Welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Yes, thank you. That's where we are.
Yeah, the anti-Trump conspiracy lives. There's been a throwdown by the White House over this impeachment inquiry, as it's been called, by Nancy Pelosi, I guess fundamentally sort of challenging its legitimacy and therefore making clear that the administration is not going to cooperate with it. I'm interested in what you make of this, but in particular, Diana, I'm anxious to have you talk a little bit based on your long study of the left and its tradecraft, if you will, about two elements that seem to be at work here in this impeachment endeavor by the Democratic caucus in the House, specifically deflection and projection. Talk about those, if you would.
Well, these are tactics of distraction. If you think about politics as being run by a bunch of magicians who are not sincerely executing anything resembling the people's business, but are rather there to confuse the people about what their business is, they reach into a bag of tricks that are in the world of spycraft known as deflection. And also the world of magic. I mean, this is about creating illusions, and the best of the intelligence wars have been basically based in illusions and confusions and making the enemy. I mean, this goes back to Sun Tzu. This is actually military doctrine. Yes, the best kinds of military strategies are when the enemy is confused about the strength of the opposing forces, about the strategies, about the direction they're marching, I mean, everything. So strategy is an important deception is a key point in all of these kinds of ways of seizing and holding and getting power. So we are looking right now at the mass media harnessed to a duplicitous left in this country, with much of the right involved in that left, aimed at deceiving the American people, who are at this point and always the base of power for this president, Donald Trump. And that's kind of the umbrella of distraction and deflection. And in the specifics, we are looking at this distraction of impeachment, which is not even a real impeachment. I mean, the deception here is that a real impeachment is going forward. We have not seen a vote. We are seeing all kinds of strategies to hide evidence gathering from the people, from the president's lawyers, the procedures here.
Hide witnesses as well.
And witnesses as well. And so, in other words, we are watching a creation of an impeachment, a creation of crime, a creation of all of these things that are being spun up to drive the people away from the president. I mean, I think that this has nothing to do with carrying out constitutional duties. This is all about 2020 and seizing power in ways that do not rely on a normal procedure at the ballot.
Yeah, especially when the Democratic field seems to be so pathetically weak and unable to likely beat him at the polls. But how about this term projection, Diana West? Because we're watching against the backdrop of abundant evidence of Democrats' involvement in influence operations in places like Ukraine, and yes, involvement in ways that clearly were designed to affect elections here to some extent, in some cases, in other cases, less so. But what is projection, and how does it play into this bag of tricks that the left often uses?
Well, it is essentially creating the illusion that what you are doing is actually underway in someone else. I mean, in other words, that your crimes are actually being committed by someone else. And this goes back right to the very beginning of this hoax against Donald Trump, going back to the whole Russian collusion narrative, where we saw the Democratic Party enlisting Russians in the creation of the Steele dossier. People forget about that, perhaps. Remember Old Home Week.
To influence an election.
To influence an election. And this is the kind of thing that now we are watching constructed again against Donald Trump. I mean, none of these things are straight on political debate, civil discourse, nothing. This is all madness. And indeed, I think a lot of it is targeting not just the American people's relationship with Donald Trump, but Donald Trump himself. I mean, the rigors, the tortures, the torment that he is subjected to in this whole fiasco as a single human being. I mean, we think of him, yes, he's the president, which is an enormous office, but he's a man. He's a man. And this kind of pressure is so, I don't think we've ever seen any, yes, it's crushing, and I don't think we've ever seen its like before. This is abuse heaped on a person who is the president in order to break him, break his presidency, and steal an election.
Yep, wear him down for sure. Diana West, this throwdown, as I put it, of the administration with Nancy Pelosi is obviously going to be playing out for some time, and we'll be watching it closely, as will you, I know. I did want to ask you quickly about one other topic that I'm going to discuss at a bit greater length with Joseph Bosco in a moment, but to get your thoughts on it. Communist China has forced the National Basketball Association of the United States to engage in what I think in ancient Chinese dynasties is called the kowtow. Talk about what's going on there, and what are the implications if Chinese restrictions on speech are, as they insist, to be promulgated globally?
Well, it's utterly staggering. I mean, this is a really important story. I don't think anyone saw it coming. And it came out of a statement of support for Hong Kong, for democracy.
A tweet, I believe.
A mere tweet. And we've seen these series of just disgusting events follow. And it just is staggering to think that the NBA has such a tight relationship with China that it has performed the kowtow. I mean, who was aware of that? I certainly was not. There is something here that we possibly don't even understand in terms of this relationship, because my first feeling would be that the Chinese need the NBA a whole lot more than the NBA ever needs China. I mean, I don't understand the reliance here and this master-serf relationship that we're watching unfold.
So, but unfortunately, it is now increasingly evident that that's the kind of relationship the Chinese insist on having with everybody. Diana, we'll be talking more about it, as I say, with Joe Bosco, but thank you for sharing some insights with us as well. Come back to us next week.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Joseph Bosco, a man that I have come to regard as one of the real thought leaders on what's afoot with communist China. It's a subject that he has studied closely for many years and had some very important professional responsibilities for dealing with as the desk officer for the country of the PRC in the office of the Secretary of Defense, among other important responsibilities he had in that office. These days, he is a senior fellow at the Institute for Korea-America Studies and also a very important, indeed founding member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. He is an attorney by training, highly skilled in the kinds of issues that we're talking about in this program, and he also brings to bear his expertise as a former communications officer in the United States Navy, serving in the Western Pacific, a student under Henry Kissinger as well, among many other exploits. Joe Bosco, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Nice to be with you.
Joe, I would like to start by talking a bit about Hong Kong and why it is so important and why we're seeing the Chinese Communist Party lashing out so aggressively against the National Basketball Association for one of the general managers of its teams having the temerity to tweet that he thinks we should stand with Hong Kong. What's that all about?
Well, I think it is a wonderful opportunity for the United States to both espouse its own values worldwide and to resist what China is trying to impose on the world in terms of its set of authoritarian values, that is, speak no evil of our wonderful Chinese communist government. And that's what's happening now in Hong Kong. The people are speaking a lot about what's happening with their rights that were guaranteed by the communists and have gone, by the way, as all promises made by communist governments want to do. So I think it's they're standing up quite nicely, and the general manager of the Rockets has also taken a stand, and I hope he will adhere to it.
Well, he has withdrawn it and apologized, as I understand it, under extraordinary pressure, obviously, from the NBA. And I guess, Joe, knowing China as you do, you were not surprised, but it sure is, I think, shocked an awful lot of other Americans, as you say. It's a real teachable moment that the Chinese are asserting that their norms, their speech restrictions, for example, must now be observed universally, no matter what our Constitution says about freedom of speech, lest we face very extreme punishment from them. In the case of the NBA, I'm told it may be $600 million worth of goods and broadcast rights and all kinds of things. Is this something that we are supposed to just get used to, or should we take this as a very ominous sign of things to come and start resisting?
Well, I think it's not a matter of necessarily of things to come. They've been coming for quite some time, and it's taken us quite a while to wake up to it. China's export of its values is a given now. It applies in their investments in Africa and elsewhere around the world. It always comes with the condition that the Chinese will dictate the labor conditions and environmental conditions and all the rest of it. By that, I mean they will not observe those standards that are universally observed elsewhere. So it's not new. But what I think is interesting in this situation with the NBA, it demonstrates the incredible weakness of the regime. They are so brittle, so fragile, that they cannot allow an American sports figure to express a personal opinion about something happening in Hong Kong. And I think it ought to be a lesson to the United States government that this is the way, this is the opportunity for us to deal with China. No one wants to get into a war, a shooting war with the People's Republic, but we cannot stand for what they're doing and what they're exporting around the world. And the way to deal with it is to hit them at their most vulnerable point, which is human rights and democratic values and rule of law.
Well, the very legitimacy of the regime. I remember vividly, as I know you do, Joseph Bosco, that Ronald Reagan probably struck his most important blows against the old Soviet Union, the last totalitarian communist enterprise that sought our destruction, by describing it properly as the evil empire. And describing how he intends to put them on the ash heap of history and all that, it was powerfully resonant with, I think, an awful lot of Russians. So, Joe, I wanted to just do a shout out to you for many of your essays that you have published often at The Hill. But one that really, I think, was extraordinarily powerful was on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. talk a little bit about your assessment of the threat that Chinese communism poses today, 7 decades on.
Well, it's interesting that was the period. It was founded by Mao Zedong, whose living axiom is political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. He demonstrated that over and over again in China as he took over and killed up to 80 million people. The estimates vary. What's a 10 million here or there? But the Western experts have long dismissed that as, well, an aberration, a period that is ancient history. But then it was revived again in 1989 when the people, like the people in Hong Kong, the Chinese people, decided they needed to have more political rights like the rest of the free world. And, of course, Deng Xiaoping, the great reformer, cracked down and killed we don't know how many thousands of students and workers in Tiananmen Square and other Chinese cities. So the pattern, and now we're seeing the pattern again resume in Hong Kong. The point is that the nature of the Chinese communist system has never changed since its inception. It's built into it. It's in its DNA. It's part of communist ideology that brute force and power ultimately determine the course of history, and they are going to use it wherever they choose. I find it particularly fascinating that the Chinese communist government constantly talks about the opium wars and the century of humiliation and all the wrongs that were done, real or imagined, to the Chinese people long ago, but they don't want the Chinese people to know about what happened under the Cultural Revolution. They don't want them to know what happened in Tiananmen Square. They don't want them to know what's happening right now in Hong Kong and Xinjiang, East Turkestan. So they have a very skewed and selective use of history. And we ought to be able to counter that by telling the Chinese people the truth, the full story about history.
Yeah. And meanwhile, our own sense of history is being increasingly dumbed down, both by our academic institutions and by the increasing influence operations that the Chinese are engaged in our country, whether it's the Confucius Institutes on our academic campuses or whether it's the advertising supplements, as they're called, in the places like the Washington Post and the New York Times. And Joe, again, as a close student of these things, I know you appreciate that we are extremely at risk if we don't understand accurately both the historic character of this Chinese Communist Party and its global ambitions. And I wanted to turn to one last thing. As a member of the Committee on the Present Danger of China that I know you have been following closely and I think are very engaged in, and that is the prospect that much of this peril from China, whether it's increasing repression at home and its ability to export the techniques of, you know, state security, if you will, to other nations, or it's just overt aggressiveness towards us and our interests, it's being enabled to a very substantial degree by investments, American pension funds and other institutional investors and even individuals are making in Chinese companies that are part and parcel of this kind of bad behavior. And Joe, I just would ask you, as a man who has served in government, I assume at least at some point you had your own personal retirement funds in the Thrift Savings Plan, as it's called, of the federal government. Military personnel, active duty, and veterans have as well as other civilian government employees. What do you think of the prospect that we're at the cusp, perhaps, of having those funds also invested in some of these Chinese companies that are doing very, very ominous things to us and our interests and allies?
It's an incredibly disturbing development. It's just a continuation of what's been happening. And I think our colleagues on the committee have done a masterful job in exposing the danger to what is happening there. And I think we need to continue the campaign to alert government officials and congressional people and others as to what the real danger that exists from the financial standpoint. China's already been exploiting Western investment in China for decades, but now they're right into our system and have bleeding American dollars into their corrupt practices and their aggressive practices. So I think that we're on to something and we need to continue.
Yeah. And Joe, just again, knowing the Chinese communists as you do, would you put it past them to try to exploit the fact that Americans have their pension funds invested in Chinese companies? Well, to exercise the kind of dominance that we've seen them do towards the NBA as we speak.
Absolutely not. And the most recent example of that is in this trade confrontation with the Trump administration. The first thing they did when the president imposed the tariffs was to cut off farm purchases to hit us politically in the heartland of America.
Right. Yeah, case in point. Joe, we have to leave it at that. I appreciate so much your service to our country in government and that you are continuing to render these days at the Korea America Institute. It's deeply appreciated, as are your periodic contributions to our understanding of what's going on through the Hill and, of course, at the Committee on the Present Danger of China. I hope you'll come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Michael Pregent right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a delight to say we're joined by one of the smartest guys I know on the battlefronts of the Middle East and literally, in the most operational sense, the battle spaces that we have been, well, engaged in for quite some time with mixed results at best. His name is Michael Pregent. He formerly served in the United States Army as an intelligence officer for some 20 years. He has continued to serve his country in a variety of capacities, including these days as a senior fellow at the highly regarded Hudson Institute. He contributes to the public policy debate in numerous outlets, including The Daily Beast and The Wall Street Journal. He is one of those go-to guys, which when things go south in the Middle East, we find ourselves turning to. And I'm very pleased that he's taking some time to talk us through the latest developments, particularly in Syria. And welcome back, Michael Pregent. So good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Frank. Appreciate it.
Well, where to begin? I guess perhaps with a phone call between Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, a putative ally of this country, at least in a formal sense, and Donald Trump over the weekend. What do we know about that conversation? And then we'll get into what seems to have flowed from it.
Well, it sounds like Erdogan convinced Trump that he could take over the counter-ISIS mission in northern Syria, but he didn't call it ISIS. He called it an operation against terrorists. And what that actually meant, those terrorists are U.S. allies in the YPG. And that's why Turkey is going to move into northern Syria to go ahead and negate the gains made by the U.S. Syrian Defense Force partnership to clear and hold territory that ISIS had taken over.
Previously held.
Yeah, previously held. We're already seeing security degradation. We're already seeing massing on the border. And it's not a counter-ISIS mission. It's a counter-U.S. ally mission by a NATO ally.
Right. Again, a nominal NATO ally, but I'm increasingly convinced that if there were a way to expel Turkey from NATO, we probably would be working to do that, or we certainly should, but there isn't at the moment. So it remains a NATO ally, even though Turkey is behaving very much contrary, I think, to our interests in a lot of different ways. But staying with Syria, Michael Pregent, just let's define some of these terms. YPG, of course, is an acronym for Kurdish forces, as is the Syrian Democratic Forces. They have been allied with us in the effort to, as you say, expel the Islamic State, destroy the caliphate, done much of the heavy lifting. There is a part of the YPG that the Turks consider to be terrorists, and frankly, we have over the years too, the PKK. Am I right?
Yes, exactly. That is all true. The problem is we used these Kurdish forces in northern Syria to go after ISIS. Instead of building what we should have built, which would be a Sunni Arab force of Syrians to push back against a Sunni terrorist threat, we used the wrong proxy. But because we worked with them and because we asked them to do very difficult things, you can't abandon them we keep having these recent examples of betrayal, whether it be the Iraqi Peshmerga, the Iraqi Kurds, and now the Syrian Kurds. And it's going to get harder and harder for U.S. special operators and advisors on the ground in future conflict to get indigenous forces to do things with these recent examples of betrayal. And it continues to happen.
I guess the thing that's particularly painful about this is that, in part, we wound up using Kurds as our principal ground forces in both northern Iraq and northeastern Syria, Michael Prigent, because there weren't good alternatives. At least we had not been able to establish relationships with people that were reliable there. And to that extent, this makes, as I say, doubly alarming that we are abandoning these allies with whom we have fought now for quite some time. And I think your point is really critically important here, that we're not going to be able to go back to that well again in the future if we need to. So when you hear Donald Trump talking about, well, we'll go in and we'll blast the Turks if they do things we don't like, or we'll destroy their economy, does that sound incredible to people on the ground who you have known and worked with for quite some time?
No, it doesn't, because look what we have allowed Assad to do. We condemned Assad. We conducted a couple of cruise missile strikes that did not degrade Assad's military at all. The UN is also condemning Turkey if they move in, or the EU, Germany, France, are set to condemn Turkey if they move into northern Syria. Well, all those countries have condemned Assad's use of chemical weapons and barrel bombs, and it never stopped anything. These threats to be upset about something aren't enough of a deterrent to get Erdogan to move his forces in to take out a U.S. ally. Now, he is a NATO ally, but a NATO ally should listen, right, to NATO. This is an ally that's not listening. This is a very different NATO ally, and like you said, a wavering NATO ally. And I do like the strong language coming from Lindsey Graham about sanctions, about exiting Turkey from NATO if they could continue these types of provocations. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I think Erdogan's very comfortable. And now we're seeing a partnership between Turkey and Russia to move into these areas. How does that benefit the United States? How does that benefit the security situation? And the president's at risk of having security degradation and an ISIS resurgence ahead of a 2020 election. The same thing you criticized President Obama for, by, you know, when he said Obama left Iraq too soon, and that led to the rise of ISIS. Trump's putting himself in that same situation.
Right. And let's just drill down on that for a moment, Michael Prigent. With respect to the Islamic State, we're told that the caliphate is destroyed, and therefore we can safely exit from Syria, or at least move forces away from the northeastern area where the Turks are poised to invade. How do you see that? And in particular, what would the implications be if the Kurds, who are currently essentially incarcerating something on the order of 70,000 ISIS forces and dependents, were to say, you're on your own, we're going to go, you know, focus our efforts on protecting our people against the Turks?
Right. So ISIS is not defeated. We simply knocked down buildings. ISIS has learned that unless you can shoot down an American aircraft, don't claim that you hold any territory. ISIS is not defeated. It has had territory taken away from it, but it's still there. And to your point about the YPG, our Kurdish allies are holding roughly about 10,000 ISIS fighters. There's no incentive for them to keep them. There's an incentive to release them into the battlefield so they can cause havoc for Assad, so they can cause havoc for Russia, so they can cause havoc for Iran. But the biggest problem I have is that Turkish forces aren't moving in to deal with this ISIS threat. Remember, they laid an overwatch to watch ISIS move on Kobani, a Kurdish-held town. In broad daylight, ISIS was attacking a city while the Turkish armor battalion watched.
Well, in fact, is it not the case, Michael, that the Turks have actually enabled the ISIS fighters? They've, as I've understood it, provided safe passage for them through Turkey. They've provided safe haven for them, even, you know, to do R&R when the battlefield becomes too intense for them. Is that right?
It was a very porous border. I'll leave it at that. If you're an ISIS fighter, you literally have no problem crossing into Turkey and then crossing back into Syria.
And I think getting resupplied in the process, in some cases at least. Hey, Michael, there's so much more to talk about Syria, and I want to at greater length with you if we can in the near future. But for the moment, let me just turn to another player we haven't talked about yet, but that also, I assume, would stand to benefit from this withdrawal of U.S. forces if it clears the way for the kind of rearranging of the deck chairs, if you will, in Syria, and that would be Iran. How do you see them positioning themselves in the event that the United States does, in fact, leave not large numbers of forces, but get them entirely out of the country?
Well, an ISIS resurgence benefits Iran because it justifies Iran's position in Syria. It allows them to justify moving Iraqi militias into Syria to deal with an ISIS threat. I'm putting that in air quotes because it's never about ISIS. It's always about securing strategic objectives for Iran in Syria and Iraq. And they'll use this. They'll use this as an opportunity to create more havoc in Iraq, in northern Iraq, as these Kurdish refugees start moving into Iraq. Iraq's already in a fragile state with these protests, largely against the Iranian presence in Iraq. And this instability just gives Tehran an excuse to be in Iraq and Syria under the guise of fighting terrorists.
And presumably to continue beavering away at that Shiite crescent, as it's been called, that would give them the land bridge to Lebanon, right?
It's already in place. The land bridge is alive and well. The good thing is it's a target-rich environment for the Israeli Air Force. The land bridge cannot be protected from air attacks, and that's a good thing. And that's causing a schism between Russia and Iran because Qasem Soleimani, the leader of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, thought those S-300s and 400s in Syria were there to protect his land bridge. It's not. And that's a good thing. We need to create those schisms and try to do this right. We're not very good about doing these things right.
And that's primarily, I guess, as a part of a modus vivendi between Israel and the Russians. But what about Russia, Michael, very quickly? Where does it fit into this Syrian jumble?
Well, it benefits also. We're seeing coordination between the Russians and the Turkish military now to move into these areas cleared by the U.S., and that's an issue. Russia continues to capitalize on a fragile security situation in the Middle East, even joking about offering Saudi Arabia S-400s to protect against Iranian attacks. And you saw Zarif's laughing in that crowd. I don't know if you saw that. When Putin encouraged the Saudis to buy S-400 systems, and Zarif could be seen chuckling at the same time.
Yeah. Qui bono, as they say, is a critically important question here. Who's going to benefit? Michael Prigent, thank you for walking us through the numbers of countries, all of whom have in common, I think, their hostility towards this nation that would benefit, I'm afraid, from a precipitous withdrawal from Syria. We appreciate the work you do at the Hudson Institute. I hope you will come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, Michael Cutler joins us straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Michael Cutler is in the house. Well, virtually at least. He is, of course, a veteran of the Immigration and Naturalization Service for some 30 years, serving in a variety of capacities, really on the front lines of our border and immigration policy battle space. And we are so appreciative of his work there. He is a frequent contributor to our understanding of the nature of that battle space and the character of the threats we're facing in it. Notably, on this program, of course, from time to time, but also at the David Horowitz Freedom Center's Front Page magazine. You can also find him at his own radio program, the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio. Michael Cutler, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us, sir.
Great to join you, Frank. By the way, you know, this is the beginning of the new year for those of us in the Jewish faith, but no matter how you measure the year, I hope it's a good one, a peaceful one, and a healthy one for you and for your listeners.
Amen. Thank you so much. Let me ask you about the prospects of that. You've written a piece just recently at Front Page about sort of a retrospective on what has happened 18 years after 9/11 that unfortunately leaves us still quite vulnerable to terror attacks inside this country. Why so?
Well, you know, it's remarkable. I wrote this piece for frontpagemag.com, Front Page Magazine, again, sponsored by David Horowitz. And I found something interesting. If you remember, after 9/11, all the politicians stood at the podium and pounded it and said, why didn't they connect the dots? Well, remarkably, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing in 1998, 2 days short of the fifth anniversary of the bombing of the Trade Center. This was February 24th, 1998. And none other than Dianne Feinstein espoused policy concerns voiced by President Trump today. Talked about how we ought not be perhaps engaging in the visa waiver program, shouldn't be admitting aliens from countries that sponsor terrorism, and shouldn't be educating those citizens of countries that sponsor terrorism in such areas of science as physics and biology and chemistry, because her concern was that we're teaching our enemies how to make weapons of mass destruction, which is astonishing because this was 4 years nearly before 9/11. So when they said, why didn't they connect the dots clearly had been connected years earlier, but the politicians, for a bunch of corrupt reasons, refused to acknowledge those dots.
Yeah.
And nobody rioted, by the way, and nobody picketed, and nobody fainted.
And yet that would be a policy stance that I think she would be running from as fast as her legs could carry her today. And there would be rioting, certainly among her partisan cohort. But the point is not simply that we're failing to understand the nature of the threat, but the threat itself, the jihadist, if you will, or Sharia supremacist form particularly, is still very much with us, is it not?
Yes. And in fact, so then I wrote a follow-up article that the president of Harvard University was concerned because a young man with a Lebanese passport who identified himself as a Palestinian entering Harvard as a freshman biology student, go back to what Dianne Feinstein said, the inspectors at the airport of entry, the Customs and Border Protection folks, looked at the guy's laptop. They found postings that were extremely anti-American, virulently anti-American, posted not by him but by his friends, but nevertheless they were on the computer. He was interviewed at length, and they decided to not admit him. Countries are not compelled to admit foreign nationals. We only have to admit our own citizens, not foreign nationals, just as you don't have to let a stranger into your home. And so they let him, they sent him back, and eventually he was allowed in. But the president of Harvard wrote this big complaint to the government, to the Justice Department, to Homeland Security. And he said, scientific research must be open and collaborative, irrespective of where people come from. And I thought back to the Rosenbergs, who provided research from those laboratories concerning nuclear weaponry, and they paid with their lives, and understandably so. So here you have the president of Harvard, who probably doesn't understand the real world, saying that all research and science must be open and collaborative. You could wind up, and by the way, I wonder where he stands on the issue of nuclear nonproliferation. We've got to be careful that we don't educate the people with the ways by which they might kill all of us. But this Mr. Harvard over there couldn't get it through his thick skull. And I made the point that there's often the difference between being educated and being smart. Clearly, he's not a very smart guy.
It calls to mind that wonderful turn of phrase by William F. Buckley about rather being ruled by the first, 150 people in the phone book than the faculty of Harvard. But unfortunately, this is not, an anomalous position by this president. It is held by a great many people in the scientific community in this country, and we've let, as a result, among others, Chinese nationals into our national nuclear weapons laboratories, something that has turned into proliferation of the worst kind.
Yeah, they've been sharing it with our enemies, with Iran and North Korea. And by the way, we trained their computer programmers so they could hack our computers. They built up those artificial islands in the South China Sea to attempt to gain dominance and control over that very important region using the technology that they stole from us by espionage.
It's not only the technology, Michael Cutler, as you may be aware, we were just talking about this with Joseph Bosco, it's with our money that we are investing into the companies that do the construction and fortification of these islands in the South China Sea, which almost certainly will be used against our interests, if not against our own personnel. And now we're at the cusp of having people like you who I suspect at least at some point had money invested in the thrift savings plan, having your funds tapped for that purpose, building those islands, incarcerating the Uyghurs, building weapon systems.
The communists said the capitalists will sell you the rope with which you will hang them. We're having a fire sale on rope, aren't we?
Well, we're paying for the rope is the further fillip of it from now on. Michael Cutler, let me just turn to one last item, which also speaks to this question of the threat here. You wrote a very disconcerting piece, also at Front Page Magazine, back on September 25th, about a Hezbollah sleeper who was arrested in New York City. Tell us what we know about this particular individual, but also more generally, Michael, about the presence in our country of one of the most dangerous terrorist organizations in the world, the Iranian proxy group Hezbollah.
Well, you know, there was a hearing that was held. Before we get to the specific, let's go to Hezbollah real quickly. Hezbollah, of course, has its origins in Lebanon. We know that there are Hezbollah training camps throughout Latin America. They're sponsored, funded, and directed at the behest of Iran. And you know where the relationship, if you want to call it that, with Iran is headed. And so we have a statement by an expert, Dr. Emmanuel Ottolenghi, at a Senate hearing about a year ago in April of last year about Iran operating throughout the world. And what this expert said, and nobody refuted, you know, sometimes I've been before a bunch of hearings as an expert witness, you'll have other witnesses refuted. Nobody refuted what the guy said. He talked about how Iran, this is his statement now, in recent years, Hezbollah's Latin American networks have also increasingly cooperated with violent drug cartels and criminal syndicates, often with the assistance of local corrupt political elites, and went on to say that this toxic crime terror nexus is fueling both the rising threat of global jihadism and the collapse of law and order across Latin America that is helping to drive drugs and people northward into the United States. Think about that. It is sustaining Hezbollah's growing financial needs, helping Iran and Hezbollah consolidate a local constituency in multiple countries across Latin America. See, we hear Hezbollah, we think Middle East. We're talking here Latin America, right across the border from Mexico, right? It is thus facilitating their efforts to build safe havens for terrorists and a continent-wide terror infrastructure they could use to strike U.S. targets. Meanwhile, for all the talk about how the Democrats and Republicans will never agree on immigration, the Republican-controlled Senate just 2 weeks ago voted to end the declaration of emergency declared by President Trump along the Mexican border. And apparently, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, and the drug cartels have not yet gotten the memo. So they said, we don't need a wall. We don't have to worry about the Mexican border. Meanwhile, two sleeper agents, one individual, believe it or not, and I wrote about him previously, was arrested. This guy we figured out who he was when he applied to attend flight school in Oklahoma. It turns out that he was a classmate of the 9/11 hijackers in Afghanistan. They actually found his application to join Al-Qaeda. And here he is in the United States learning to fly airplanes. And when you look at the conviction, because he was just found guilty a week ago, the Justice Department issued a press release. I'll be writing about this guy, the follow-up. He had correspondence and was going on Facebook to advocate for the positions of radical Islam. So he's going to jail.
Michael Cutler, this is why we value your participation in this program so much. You're bringing these sorts of stories to our attention and helping connect the proverbial dots as to what we must do about them. Thank you for your time today, sir. Come back to us again soon, Michael, if you will, please. And I hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.